بشرع تتسقط عنده ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا بشار
ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا بشار
ويا بشار ويا كذاب وتضرب انت وهالخطاب الحرية صارت على الباب ويلا ارحل يا بشار
يلا ارحل يا بشار
ويلا ارحل يا بشار ويا بشار ويا كذاب وتضرب انت وهالخطاب الحرية صارت.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
It's a pleasure being with you.
And the UN report just came out today about this terrible war that's cost 70,000 lives so far and is becoming increasingly sectarian. This has prompted Carla Del Ponte, the UN human rights investigator, to tell the UN Security Council that it's time to refer the issue to the war, the issue of war crimes to the International Criminal Court. Of course, Joshua, that's dead on arrival, is it not, because of the veto power of Russia and China?
It is indeed, and it complicates the situation because there are so many human rights violations on both sides of this war. As it becomes nastier and nastier, we've seen people executed, prisoners executed, torture, rape. This has descended into, you know, very difficult to adjudicate and for foreigners to adjudicate from afar in this way.
So, obviously, the preponderance of violence has come from the government from day one, and they've been using an air force to bomb hospitals, yeah. Universities, people lining up at bakeries. They seem to have really gone after specific high death toll targets. In a way, and you correct in as much as we've seen video of massacres on both sides. Tell us though about this what is starting to develop now. At least it seems to me that there's a kind of a war within this war, a war between the Sunni extremist al-Nusra militia and the extremist Shiite militia Hezbollah.
Well, we are seeing Hezbollah has had a number of people die, and indicating that they're playing an increasingly an important role. And there are a number of Shiite villages in Syria along the Lebanese border. And Hezbollah has moved out into these Shiite villages and is protecting them. And as revolutionary activity moves from town to town, it's run into a roadblock at the Shiite villages, which are becoming increasingly militarized. And Hezbollah has moved across the border. Hezbollah is also, we believe, training Shabiha and advanced sort of militias in Lebanon, in Syria.
Well, the Shabiha are they're the death squads, the ghosts they call them, right?
Ghosts. They're militias that have been put together, civilian militias that have been put together under the leadership of mostly relatives of the president, Bashar al-Assad, to bolster the military. Because as Sunnis defect from the military and the military becomes smaller, there is this effort to recruit Alawites in particular and other minorities into these irregular squads that are policing towns and quarters of the cities.
So there's no way to get a real handle on where this stands militarily, right? My understanding is that essentially the line has been held in Damascus by the 4th Division. That's the son, the brother of Bashar al-Assad, Mahar, and that's the only unit that the army more or less has left, is it? So it seems like...
Well, I wouldn't say that. The military still has quite a bit of power. What we've been seeing is in the north of the country, around Aleppo, Idlib, the border with Turkey, which is about 530 miles long, stretching from the Mediterranean coast right over to Iraq. All along that border, Syria has been falling out of control of the military. The east, in Jazeera, by Iraq, where Kurds live, has fallen out of control, and increasingly the military has been withdrawing from the east and moving towards the main cities, Aleppo, Homs, Hama, and at Damascus, that run down the center of Syria. And so the regime is consolidating in the center of the country, around Damascus, Homs, Hama, and on the coast, where the Alawites are a compact minority. And it's been abandoning the north and the east of the country. So you're seeing, really, the emergence of a civil war in terms of the country dividing in two. The Syrian Air Force can still bomb all these regions at will. So it's not really a Benghazi situation as you had in Libya, where you have a liberated territory that is unaffected anymore, where a central government can begin to emerge. So you still have a very chaotic situation in the north. In the regions that are not being taken, that are held by the rebels, it's chaos. And that's one of the reasons why the government is pounding these areas. And as you said, hitting bakeries, hitting any center of normalcy, the government is hitting, because it's trying to set up a stark contrast. Rebel-hold territory, chaos, criminality, no services. Government-held territory, we're still paying salaries. There's some semblance of normalcy. And this is the way the government is trying to keep people from defecting to the other side. And it is really a scorched earth policy, as you pointed out in the beginning. And it's leaving Syrians, you know, terribly disheartened, because their country is being destroyed.
Again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. I've heard, Joshua, that a lot of the Alawites are looking to the Latakia coastal area and the mountains, the coastal mountains there, as a kind of final redout. Is that going on? Or are they still confident that they can hold on?
Well, I think that there's very divided opinions here. And the Alawites are a compact minority. In other words, most Alawites live in the coastal mountains that stretch between Lebanon and Turkey on the Mediterranean coast. Now, as you know, during the 20th century, many moved out into Damascus and some of the other cities. But increasingly, those populations that have moved into Damascus, Homs, Hama, have retreated. They've sent their families back to the coastal regions where they think they'll be safe. And they're holding on to the cities. But it's going to be a long, drawn-out battle. And there is, you know, most people believe that if the Syrian army, which is increasingly becoming an Alawite-directed military, now there's still important, you know, numbers of Sunnis and others who are fighting in the Syrian army. So it's not a completely sectarian war yet. But as they get pushed out, they will have to fall back to where their families are along the coastal region. And then they will fight tooth and nail to protect their families. And that will be a very difficult fight, because the Syrian opposition says they do not want to talk to Assad and any kind of compromise that leaves the Assad family in charge is unacceptable to the opposition. That's their stand today. But that means they really have to march in to this coastal region, even if the military falls back to it, and hunt Assad down and destroy his family and destroy what remains of the Syrian army. And that means, you know, battle until complete victory. There is not a real compromise, because most people think that Assad will hang in there, that he wants to defend his family and most of the regime members who fought for him around this kernel of regime, and that if he lays down his arms, all those people are going to be killed for war crimes. Therefore, he can't lay down his arms. And that means that the opposition has to go in, find him, and destroy him.
So, Joshua Landis, I've spoken to the spokespeople, the English-language spokesperson for the coordinated committees of the opposition, and they've for some time been expressing confidence and that once that they will win, and furthermore that once Assad goes, all of the problems will go away, and that the idea that there are these kind of jihadis coming in The Salafists, like the al-Nusra Front, are not a big problem, and they can control them. But the more reports you hear about who is doing the main fighting, you get the impression that the al-Nusra, the Salafists, who are clearly getting money from the Saudis and from the Gulf, and I believe now they're getting some advanced anti-tank weapons from Kosovo or from the Armenian mafia or something. You know, it's one of the speculations. So the CIA is supposed to be in there trying to figure out a way to arm the right people, if you will, in the opposition. And that's been, been a contentious issue all along for the British, the French, and the Americans and the Saudis. So it's a very murky picture about who's getting what arms. Do you have anything clearer than I've been sketching out here?
Well, there are, you know, by most estimates, there are about 1,000 militias operating in Syria. Now, there have been emerging some important fronts that are dominated by a few large militias. There's the Islamic Front, which is Salafist, as you've been pointing out, and al-Nusra is working in tandem with them. And then there's something called the Liberation Front, an Islamic Liberation Front, but that is working closer and more closely with the West. And it's clear that the West is trying to keep arms directed towards the more secular people. Now, we have to, you know, underline more secular, because almost everybody that are on the ground, all the militias that are doing the heavy fighting, are Islamic in one way or another. And there is not, I think, you know, the West has to come to grips with the fact there's not going to be a secular answer to Syria, just as there hasn't been in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt. This Arab Spring is, you know, increasingly we're discovering, is about empowering Islamists. And that is happening in Syria, and it's happening in a way that is quite scary for the West, because the Islamist militias are the ones that are gaining the greatest respect. They're doing the most fighting. They are the best trained and the most lethal. So, you know, many people say because the West hasn't armed secular militias, that the Islamists have really taken over the scene. And the longer the West does nothing, the more powerful they'll become. And it's the men with the guns in the end who are going to rule future Syria. But it's unclear that the West could control the outcome of this battle. We tried to control Iraq. We tried to control Afghanistan. And we haven't had a lot of luck doing it. Now, it's easy to, you know, to say if we'd only done X, Y, and Z, everything would have been hunky-dory in Syria. Unlikely to be the case. But we've seen this factionalism, which has really turned Syria into a killing ground, because it isn't an easy fight. And the government has been able to divide and rule, but the government is crumbling. The Syrian army is slowly retreating towards Damascus and the coastline. But there's still a lot of fight left in that Syrian army. And because, as you underlined in the beginning, it's becoming increasingly sectarian, neither side wants to give up, because they see this as an existential crisis and as a sort of zero-sum game. So long and bloody, I think, is the future.
So could it, just in the last minute, could it be end up as a kind of Somalia on the Mediterranean?
You know, it could. Syria has been a country and a nation state for some time now, and it's likely that we will see the Sunni militias coalesce increasingly. And we're already beginning to see it at these few major fronts that are emerging. It is likely that the Sunni Arabs, the 70% of the Syrian population, will increasingly find some kind of, even if a difficult unity, will find some sort of unity. That still leaves 30% of the country. Minorities and the Kurds, 10% Kurds who live in the northeast and who would like to have autonomy. So the battle, as you underlined earlier, even once the Assad regime falls, should it fall and when it falls, there's going to be still many battle lines that will divide Syria.
Well, Joshua Landis, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was